The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Take your seats. We're going to get started, everybody. So I wanted to just start a little bit with an introduction about the Marshall Brennan Project. Just so everybody knows, we are going to be recording this so that fellows from around the country, Marshall Brennan alumni, W. Stone alumni, anybody who's interested in education law and would like to know more about these distinguished attorneys and their work and how they got to do what they're doing, so that they'll be able to listen to the podcast from our website. So just so you know, if you could try, if you're asking questions or anything, if you could try to speak loudly, that would be great. From what I understand, they're recording everything in the room, so that means try not to have any side conversations or anything, because that will affect the quality of the recording. So I'll just give a brief background on the Marshall Brennan Project for those who might be listening who are not familiar with it. We started in 1999 here at WCL, and since then we've been sending law students from WCL and Howard Law Schools to public high schools and public charter schools in the District of Columbia to teach high school students about their constitutional rights and responsibilities. And for those who are listening, our audience today consists of about 50 or so current Marshall Brennan Fellows and some other students who are who've been invited to attend the event, who are applying for Marshall Brennan or are former fellows. And so we look forward to your questions. I think you guys are going to have really great questions for the panelists based on your experiences teaching this year, but also some of your prior experiences. And they look forward to taking those questions. The reason we're doing this panel is so that you all can have a sense of what this field is all about. It's a diverse field. It's actually, I would argue, a growing field in many ways. And so I think it's something as a law student to consider, especially with your experience in Marshall Brennan and having taught and having had exposure to schools. You may have an interest in education reform prior to this, but certainly if not, I know many of you have one now. So it's important to think about how you might be able to use your law degree to effectuate reform. So we wanted to expose you to some real experts in the field. I will say at this time, Eric Lerum actually is not going to be able to join us. He had an emergency come up, and so he's not going to be able to join us, unfortunately. But we may try to get him at another time to come visit you all. But we do have three other wonderful speakers. To my immediate left is Rachel Levinson, and she is senior counsel at the American Association of University Professors. I'm not going to read her entire bio. We will post that on the website, and you guys have it in front of you, so I won't go through too much there. But she has done some really interesting work there on a range of issues dealing with faculty and providing representation for different academic audiences. So I'll let her talk a little bit more about that in a minute. To Rachel's left is Sarah Tompkins, who is an educational attorney at the law office of Donna Wolkin, and this firm is a small private firm that represents parents and families of youth with disabilities. And so she's going to talk more about her work and how that sort of fits into this idea of careers in education law. And then finally, on the end of the panel is Julie Miscelli, who is chief of staff and special counsel to the general counsel of the Department of Education. She was kind enough to join us in the fall at our Constitution from the Courts program, so some of you may have gotten a chance to hear her speak then, and many of those who were able to attend were very impressed and enthused with her comments, and so we invited her back, and thankfully she accepted our offer. So here's the plan. I'm going to ask a few questions just to get things started, but really we want to spend a lot of time answering your questions, whether you have issues, questions about special education needs of your students, which Sarah could answer, or what it's like to work at an association, whether it's education related or not, which Rachel could answer, and then obviously any federal government questions that you might have, either in education or more generally, I think Julie could probably answer you. So just you could jot down any questions you might have as they're talking, and we would be happy to take those. After I give them a chance to say a little bit about who they are, how they ended up in their current positions. I think it's always interesting to think about that. I think sometimes as a student you think, I'm going to plot and plan and, here's my course, and oftentimes life doesn't happen that way. I don't know that that's necessarily the case of our three panelists, but I invite them to share their stories just as an example for you all of where you may find yourself in 5-10 years. Or longer. I'm also going to ask them to say, after we go through the career trajectory, we'll come back around, so if each of you can answer that question, and then I'll come back around and ask what you enjoy most about your work, and perhaps what are some of the challenges you face, so not necessarily what you don't like about where you work, but some of the challenges you face on a day-to-day basis that make what you do difficult in some ways. And then finally, I'm going to ask you to give some advice to students who might be interested in the career in education law. So let's get started with the first question, how you ended up where you are and maybe where you see yourself in the future, if you feel like you can answer that.
Sure. It's funny, sort of your characterization of how you end up someplace. I mean, I was basically going to start by saying that I feel like I fell into the job that I have now in a lot of ways. I graduated from law school, almost 9 years ago. I graduated from 2002. Worked for a year and then moved to D.C. to work for the Department of Justice. I was in the Civil Rights Division for a couple of years doing mostly Fair Housing Act litigation. And for a couple of reasons, and if people are interested, I'm more than happy also to talk about Department of Justice work in the Civil Rights Division. But for a couple of reasons, I was ready to leave there after a couple of years. In large part, honestly, I realized that I don't like litigating. I think a lot of people really do enjoy it. It wasn't something, I think I just didn't sort of enjoy spending my time that way and spending my energy that way. So I was sort of trying to figure out what I could do that was still law related, that wouldn't be litigation, but that would still have kind of a civil rights or civil liberties component to it, because that was obviously one of the things that I valued most about being in the division. And so when I started thinking about what to do next, I think in a lot of ways I wasn't sure. I sort of knew there must be a lot of other kinds of legal jobs out there, but I couldn't quite figure out, you know, what they were, what I'd want to be looking for. A lot of my friends, especially at that point, were still at firms. They were doing litigation. And so I started talking to people, talking to friends, talking to other folks. And around the same time, actually, ended up applying for the job that I have now with AAUP, and also a job in a general counsel's office at a university in town, which made me think much more about kind of being in the field of higher education, whether kind of on the faculty side or the administration side, but generally working in an area that was, you know, kind of dedicated to the mission of higher education. And the more I learned about that and the more I learned about AUP, I guess the more excited I was about the idea, especially as a practitioner, both being able to be at a place, we don't do litigation. A pretty large portion of my job is counseling the organization itself. I'm in-house counsel. There are two lawyers for the organization, kind of two and a half lawyers for the organization. And so a lot of the work that we do is advising the AUP on a huge range of things. We're a nonprofit. We have staff, we have about 48,000 members, we have chapters. So all of the issues that would come up really at any company, at any corporation, at any city, come up for a nonprofit as well. And so it's sort of working on that whole variety of issues. And then also the mission of the organization is really focused on defense of academic freedom and tenure. There are a lot of other things that we do, but that's sort of the core is higher education, academic freedom, and tenure. And so my colleague and I also do a lot of work. We do amicus briefs in the state and federal courts on a huge range of issues, some related to academic freedom and tenure, but some related to faculty contract rights, to intellectual property, sometimes collective bargaining, just a really wide range. And we also work on policy issues with our colleagues who are doing reports, who are writing policies on kind of what do we think sort of the professional standards should be in various areas, not in terms of accrediting, but just kind of feeling out, you know, what do we think, especially from a faculty point of view, should be the standards or should be the principles in a variety of areas. And I'll just say briefly, I was fortunate enough, just totally in terms of timing, I started there about 5 years ago. It'll be 5 years in May. And I happened to start about a week before a pretty significant Supreme Court case in our area came down. I don't know if it's one that you guys have encountered, a case called Garcetti v. Ceballos, which affects the speech rights of public employees. We had filed an amicus brief on that to kind of alert the court to the possible consequences of the case for public sector faculty members. And so sort of because of when I started and what my boss was doing at the time, I was kind of assigned to do the follow-up from the case. And so that's been a pretty big focus of mine, especially in the last few years, working on a policy report, doing a lot of presentations, doing amicus briefs, and working with lawyers and faculty and administrations to some extent to kind of figure out, you know, how do we try to carve out space for academic freedom within this case that's not particularly friendly to speech rights in other contexts. So, so far.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Tompkins, and I essentially what I do is do schools on behalf of children with disabilities, often the schools that you all are teaching at this semester. And I also got there in sort of a twisty way. I did a lot of clinics in law school. I totally fell in love with clinic and could not be shoehorned out of it. I stayed in one clinic for like a year and a half because I wanted to follow certain cases, and my professors were insane enough to let me do that. I'm still in touch with some of those clients, and it's been like 5 years. And during my last semester as a law student, I was supervised by Donna Wilkin, who's an educational attorney who's been practicing in the district for about 35 years. She came in as an adjunct professor for the HIV/AIDS clinic that I was working at. And so she offered to let me clerk over the summer. At that time, I had not decided whether or not I was going to take the bar yet, because I was going to graduate school the year after law school in public health. If any of you want to talk to me about wanting to take the bar very late or going to graduate school, feel free to email me questions. I have opinions on both of those things. And I wound up working for her over the summer and loved it. Loved it so much. Studying for the bar was possibly even more difficult than it already is. And I have a master's in public health from Harvard, which I never use, or very rarely use. And within the first, and this is not a reflection on Harvard, within the first month or two of being in that program, and being out of doing direct legal service, I missed it so much. I missed my clients. It took a lot for me to not call the office and see what was going on, even though I wasn't employed there anymore. And so when I was offered my job back about halfway through that, I took it. I did have the opportunity while I was in Boston to do, and I speak very fast because I'm from New York City, so I'm going to try and slow down. While I was in Massachusetts, I did have the opportunity to work with attorneys in the juvenile justice system and the abuse and neglect system and follow the school piece of a lot of those cases, which a big chunk of what I do now is, I don't know if you are familiar with PIMS petitions, but when a child is in need of services in the district or misses 143 days of school, say, the school has the option to file a civil petition against them in court and get them involved in the juvenile delinquency system. And that's just one way that I see a lot of children with special education issues that aren't being addressed getting pulled into either the juvenile justice system or the abuse and neglect system. And those are my clients. So that's sort of how I got there in a nutshell. Why I stay, and I think there's a lot, you know, I think there's a lot of literature right now about how horrible life is for urban children. There's certainly a lot that I do not have in common with my clients, but growing up, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I loved school because it was the only structure I had. You know, my mother, my only parent, was like smart enough to get me into a school where, you know, for 8 hours a day, people knew who I was. They knew my name. They knew where I was. They didn't, you know, they yelled at me when I didn't turn in my homework. They asked me where I was if I hadn't been there. And a lot of the children I work with do not have that. Like, they do not have someone, you know, they're in a building for 8 hours a day where people do not care if they live or die, if they stay or go, if they turn in homework with that's A homework, or if they turn in homework that's F homework. And so I'm so glad you guys are there because, sorry to be so emotional about that, but because it's really valuable, I think, to, you know, when you're growing up, to have structure and to have people who are going to hold you accountable. And so that's one of the reasons why I believe so strongly in what I do, is that school is really important. It's really important to have a community where you are the majority of your time that cares about you and that you know cares about you and what happens to you.
So I'm Jolene Scully, and I'm presently the Chief of Staff and Special Counsel of the U.S. Department of Education's General Counsel's Office. And I suppose if you would have asked me when I was in your shoes sitting behind a desk like that, if I thought I was going to be here, I probably would have said maybe. I was one of the very few students in my class at law school who knew exactly what area they wanted to practice. And I recognized, because I was the only one who could raise my hand if somebody asked the whole room, you know, what do you want to do? And I would say, yes, I know exactly what I want to do. And I recognize that most of you are probably not in that position yet, and my peers were not. But I got very, very lucky. I got hit over the head, I think, with a nerd stick when I was in high school. And I got very interested in the issues that our school board was paying attention to. And, you know, most kids are, you know, cheerleaders or in the band or doing something. I was going to school board meetings for some reason. So there were a lot of interesting issues that my high school had to deal with. And so I got exposed to it, you know, censoring a textbook or, you know, what should we be teaching an American history course or... you know, should the football players be praying before games? So we had to deal with that in my hometown, which is what really inspired me to want to go into education law, because at every time we had a controversy in my town, it was the lawyers who would come in and kind of reconcile a board who seemed completely splintered, and I thought, well, that was pretty cool. You had these attorneys come in, and they were the voice of reason, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I went to college, and I got an education degree, and so I had a glimpse of what it was like to be in a school, to work with kids, to try to educate them. I learned what it was like to be a teacher in a class, to work with a principal, to have struggling resources, not be able to provide everything you want to a student who needs additional supports. I worked in a school in Appalachia, Ohio. It was a county school. It was very run down at the time. This was the mid-90s. At the time, we had a whole new program in the state trying to take some of these Appalachian schools who had outdoor bathrooms and getting them actually plumbing. We had schools that didn't have electricity after certain times of the day because that's when utility companies would shut off the electricity. It was a really crazy time. And the state was actually working to really renovate those schools. So I saw poverty that I had never seen before coming from a suburb of Cleveland. So immediately after my student teaching and after having worked an additional semester with my kids, I applied to law school. I knew that that's what I wanted to do, and I did everything I could to find my way into the practice of education law. So while my peers were working with our placement office to try to get the big law firm summer position, I was applying on my own to internships at the Ohio Department of Education, the Ohio Attorney General's Office, in their education section. And actually, strangely enough, I got myself an internship at the very office I work now. The summer between my second and third year, I interned at the U.S. Department of Education's Office of the General Counsel, and I came back several years later as the Chief of Staff. And it's an office, like many federal agencies, where the staff really doesn't turn over. People are very happy to be there. They're very passionate about what they do. So I had a lot of colleagues that I had worked for as an intern that I had to step in and now start managing them. And it's a very peculiar position to be in. So I was very lucky in knowing what I wanted to do early on, but I recognize that not everybody in this room is probably in that position. But you are here because you have some interest in education law and want to know a little bit more about what options there are. And I can tell you, because I had the luxury of working at the state level, at working at a local level representing school districts, at a private firm in Chicago where I was all over the state, dealing with suburban, urban, rural districts in Illinois, seeing those kinds of districts in Ohio at the state level, and now that I'm at the federal level, there's all kinds of opportunities in education law. And even if you didn't think you were going to go into this area, I would say that it's definitely a worthwhile area to consider. And I'm sure you'll hear from the rest of us about these different opportunities. One thing I can say about education law is that you're not going to find somebody who practices this area who's not passionate about it. I think that there's a lot of more feelingless fields of the law that, you know, you can practice corporate litigation or different kind of litigation or personal injury. You're not probably going to be as invested in those areas as you would be here, because it takes that to be able to do it well. Because at the end of the day, no matter what side you're on, it's always about the kids.
You read my mind, because actually I was gonna ask you that question. To what extent do you actually expect to feel like your work every day is meaningful and like you're trying to make a difference? And to what extent do you see your colleagues feeling that sense of passion too?
Sure,
if you want to
start off. Yeah, absolutely. My colleagues, I've got a lot of attorneys who have practiced law for 30 years or more. You know, I actually have two colleagues who have been practicing law longer than I have been around. And they stick with it because there's there's so much to do, and it is so rewarding. And I just felt personally very satisfied in this field. Because when I was, for instance, when I was practicing in the private sector, I was working for a law firm in Chicago, I felt like I got a win for a kid every single day. Whether it was I had a superintendent or a principal call me and say, we found this kid with a knife in his locker. We don't know what to do. Well, there's other kids that could have been harmed. That kid could have hurt himself. I mean, there's so many different situations you have to deal with. But at the end of the day, whether it's a situation dealing immediately with a kid and what to do with that student, or it's just we need a better teacher in this classroom because this teacher is not actually working out, not helping those kids. And you work on an employment issue with a teacher, if you're able to get a better teacher in there, you've got a win for a bunch of kids. And at the federal level, you get to see it not quite, you're not as directly involved in it, but I still feel like, you know, when we make big announcements, like here's the first two races of the top winners, here's new money, two states to develop, you know, wide-reaching education reform plans for an entire state, and we know that that money is going to revolutionize the way that education is delivered in that state, yeah, you feel very personally connected to it. Good question.
So to what extent do you see yourself personally invested? I think you talked a little bit about this, but colleagues or anything in the field?
I think most educational attorneys have had some experience with education that are good. There are a lot of people in the field who have a sibling who's had a significant disability. Certainly a lot of people who apply to extern at my office had that experience. In terms of the work to gratification ratio. Many of you teach, so you know there are days where it seems like all the children I represent are doomed, and there are days where it seems like they're all doing really well. And I think you'll find that in direct legal service. Like I had a day where I got a call from a social worker because my darling charge had tortured her with a bee, a bumblebee. Over the course of 2 hours, right? And then he broke another kid's face, so that was not such a good day. He does not currently reside in the district. Although it's funny now. I got a call last week from a fourth grader who was absolutely ecstatic because she got straight A's for the first time. So, but you know, over time, and especially in comparison to other lawyers, which Julie mentioned, I actually really like all of my clients. I really like the parents. I really respect them. I'm comfortable advocating for them, and I'm never bored, which are really big pluses as an attorney. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find people uniformly in other fields that would say that, but if you ask an educational attorney if they're bored, I can guarantee you they will say never.
It's interesting. I think I come at this from a slightly different perspective, both in terms of being in higher education instead of in the K-12 context, and also being at an association. So I think all of us have an incredibly wide range of work, but maybe sort of different kinds of range. So I guess in terms sort of the question about, you know, the passion and the dedication to it, certainly I feel very strongly about the work that the association does. Higher education is changing so hugely. A lot of factors, some of it right now, there are a lot of budgetary factors, but also just the way higher education is being conceived of, I think, from our perspective, one of the things that we talk about is sort of the corporatization of higher education, and that is affecting both the experience for faculty and the experience for students, a lot of issues in public higher education in terms of speech. And so I think I and my colleagues are very passionate about and very interested in those issues. I don't think I can say that everything I do every day I'm passionate about, because a lot of it is just kind of the range of legal work. For an organization, which is one of the things that I really, this sort of goes to one of your later questions, both what do we like and what are the challenges? I think this is sort of both of there. I have a couple answers that basically speak to both of those, kind of the flip side. Some of the stuff that I'm doing, I would never want to spend all of my time doing. I don't want to be a contracts attorney full time. I don't want to be sort of, an employment attorney full time. But honestly, getting to do pieces of those actually is really fun. It's one of the things that I really like about my job. I loved law school. I really liked sort of the range of issues, and it's one of the things that I really enjoy about where I am now. And my colleagues, you know, most of my colleagues aren't attorneys. I have one colleague who is, and the rest of the staff is sort of doing a variety of work, some policy-related, some government relations-related, some just related to the operation of the association. And, I mean, I can hold off on this. That also sort of speaks to both good things and challenges. But it's really nice working with people who are really dedicated to these issues, and honestly looking at them from a non-legal point of view.
So why don't we go down that road and talk about I think you've all sort of hit on some of the highlights, but if you have others in terms of what are the things you love most about your job and some of the challenges.
Sure. In terms of the things I like the most, it is mostly things that I've touched on so far. The issues that we work on I find fascinating. I especially find, sort of the freedom of research, freedom of inquiry, freedom of expression issues especially interesting, and I felt very fortunate, just, you know, honestly, a lot of it kind of as a matter of timing, to be able to focus particularly on those and, you know, kind of get involved more in terms of the higher education community overall. I do really like the range. I think it was one of the things that I didn't like as much about being at the Civil Rights Division, although I had fantastic colleagues there, people who stay there for decades and really love it. Although certainly the division went through a somewhat difficult time, which I'm also happy to talk about if anyone wants. But I kind of felt like, in large part, I was getting to know the Fair Housing Act really well, and I wasn't as compelled by the idea of litigating one statute for years on end. Although there are certainly a lot of creative things you can do, and especially in the civil rights context, doing affirmative work, if you have strong backing, there's actually an enormous amount that you can do in that realm. But so one of the things that I really like both is, as I said, the range, and being in-house counsel in particular. I think it's probably not something that a lot of people think about coming right out of law school. And it's often hard to get in-house counsel jobs coming right out of law school because people are looking for experience in something, whether it's litigation experience or experience in a particular subject area. But it can be really nice because you're working day to day with your client. The people around me and the people whose offices I walk into every day, you know, they're the ones coming to me with questions, where I'm alerting them to problems. And there's something really nice about that. Should we talk about challenges as well? I would say the challenges are exactly the flip side of that. In part, the range, just because, you know, there are never enough people to do all of the things that are coming up. I suspect we all have that experience. I think, you know, at this point, probably anybody in any field feels that way. And specifically as a lawyer, there can be challenges to being in-house as well. There are times when I think, you know, it would be really nice, sort of the kinds of issues that I'm working on internally, so not as much in terms of the kind of higher education related issues, but literally just in terms of being a lawyer for an association. There are times when I think it would be nice to be at a law firm so that if somebody had a legal question, they would call me up, they would ask me about it, and they would actually want the legal advice that I would then be giving them because they would have committed to asking about it. Whereas often my role basically is to show up in somebody's office or call someone on the phone because I'm seeing the operations of the association. I'm involved in all of the business, basically. And I call them and say, look, you may not realize this, but there's this vulnerability here. There's this weakness here. You know, and then there's a lot of other, you know, okay, that's not just a political issue. I mean, not just a legal issue. It's a small P political issue. It's a budget issue. There's a lot that goes into it. And so I think that can also be a very hard piece as an in-house attorney, having those relationships with your client that you're working with, but knowing that there are times that they're going to be hearing from you that, frankly, they don't want to, and kind of navigating that as well.
I think Julie can relate.
Yes, I was going to say probably a lot of this is familiar.
Yeah, Rachel, absolutely. There are some pitfalls of being in-house counsel, and as you were saying, it's, you know, what's a nice strength of being in-house and also working in school law, actually wherever you are, is you have a microcosm of a world that's your client. You get to deal with everything, employment, labor, contracts, First Amendment, constitutional issues, due process, all kinds of stuff. But as far as the in-house comments, that was hilarious because, yeah, you can't fire your client when you're in-house. And you can't go and work on something, you know, for another client who's, you know, I'm going to go work with a better client and separate myself from the situation. It's scary, I think, as a lawyer to see the day-to-day operations because there's vulnerability in almost every conversation that your clients will have about, here's a great new idea, we should do X. And as a lawyer, you can go, well, you should maybe you got to think about this, and nothing would get done if lawyers were in a room all the time as new ideas were being thought through. And so what is nice, and to your point, Rachel, is when you're working in a law firm, that, you know, it hits the fan when they call you. They call, you know, if your client is calling you at a law firm, they need you there to come in and fix the problem. Whereas your in-house perspective is you're trying to stop problems, which often feels like you're trying to
stop progress.
Yeah, stop progress, or you know, and it's often a train just running at a, you know, down a track that you can't stop, and you're trying to get in front of. So it is a huge challenge for us. But the benefit is, I think, the range. I think that you nailed that. You get to do so much. In fact, you're going to love this, Rachel. But I have often told groups that I speak to that I think the smartest lawyer you will find out there in the field is very likely a general counsel at a big university because they have to be good at everything. You know, it's really easy to become the best motions lawyer or the best corporate litigator or the best, you know, in-house counselor. But to be, you know, in-house at a big university when you're dealing with every issue and you've got to be good at it, that's where I think the best lawyers actually end up.
I have many clients that don't go to my office, which is very small, so that is good. In terms of pros, you know, direct legal service is awesome, you know, you get to kind of bear witness to people's lives in a way that is both not particularly invasive, but where you get to do a lot of good. And I do litigation, which is a lot of fun being in trial. Like, it's really the only time I've ever found that I can completely shut off that, like, hamster wheel in my mind about everything else because you really have to focus because there's a judge there. The flip side to that is there's, like, a trial by fire unpredictably element to trial, and you have to become comfortable. And for me, it takes a while, and sometimes it's daily practice. Of facing that you are going to make a giant mistake, if you're lucky weekly, often more often than that, often in front of a judge or another attorney, and very much so as you're younger. Like, I didn't understand objections during my second trial. It was awful. I objected to future telling and like took a few, that was actually what I said objection calls for future telling, and when the judge asked me what I meant by that, I said counsel is asking the witness to prophecy, because I didn't know what I was doing, and then the judge said, perhaps Ms. Tompkins, you mean calls for speculation. I said, yes! Thank you! That was also the trial where my client cursed out opposing counsel in the middle of the hearing. And the opposing counsel very nicely said, can you tell your client not to say anything to me under her breath? And I was like, that wasn't under her breath. Okay. I was clearly on the record. So that's a big, and what Rachel and Julia said about not enough people to do a lot of work, and there's always something at the end of the day that is lingering and having to figure out like where you need to set boundaries because you're going to drive yourself crazy. Has been like a pitfall, but also a growth experience for me.
Great. So going to the last question, Rachel, you mentioned that it's hard to get an in-house counsel right out of law school, and I would say it's probably even impossible now, given that there's so many attorneys with experience who are available. So that said, though, for somebody who's interested in this field, and let's say they're interested in in-house or not, maybe other positions within education law, what advice would you give to a 2L, let's say, who's thinking about that now in terms of what they can do to get to that point?
It's a chance. Just talking to I was at a conference a couple of weekends ago, specifically actually a kind of law and higher education conference, and there were some students there. So one of them was
sort of saying, what would I do? And in some ways, in a hard time answering the question, I'll give you my thoughts, and I'd be really interested to hear what Julie's are as well. Because I think in some ways, the answer is, what are you interested in? And I guess I say that because I think there are so many routes to end up in-house. It very much depends kind of what you're interested in from the beginning, the size of in-house counsel that you're going to end up in. So just thinking about a couple of people that I know who've ended up in-house in different contexts. So whether it be in a university general counsel's office or in a corporate context, you know, I know people who have been really interested in tax and in maybe nonprofit tax or other issues, have built up some expertise in that area. And then they're actually, I don't know if anyone here is thinking of going to tax law, they're actually very interesting tax policy issues, especially in the nonprofit context. And so people have developed an expertise in that area and then been able to take that into an in-house context. Obviously, I came in, I don't even want to say I came in as a generalist. I mean, I came in with really not a lot of background. I had grown up in a faculty household. My father was a law professor, and so I think I had some sort of connection to academia that helped a little bit, but really to a large extent, I was learning on the job, and I think partly my boss who hired me decided that it seemed like I would be able to learn on the job. And they were looking for somebody, certainly who had some experience out of law school, but I think, quite frankly, they couldn't afford somebody who was 10 or 15 years out of law school. So, you know, I was, what, 3 or 4 years out at that point. That was around what they were looking for. You know, I also know people who have litigated for a long time and then gone in-house, maybe at a corporation, where the in-house counsel's office is large enough that people are actually specializing, and so they bring in litigation experience or intellectual property experience. And so it's hard in some ways because I think it partly depends on if you want to go in-house, do you want to get there sort of from a route of specializing or being a generalist? And if it's the generalist route, then I think in some ways it's sort of the catch-22 of basically where you get generalist experience is in an in-house counsel's office. I think even most law firms now probably people are specializing more and more. And in that context, maybe in some ways the best background is litigation, if you're in kind of a general litigation practice, because you're likely to see so many areas and you'll be getting in the meantime, you know, there's a lot of writing experience and a lot of sort of investigation experience and just sort of learning how to practice. So I don't know how helpful that is, but I do think honestly a lot of people sort of fall into in-house practice. And so it's kind of a matter of what are you doing that strikes your fancy and can you find a way that fits in-house somewhere well.
If you're staying in the District of Columbia, there's educational law from us in terms of parent representation is pretty big here. There are a lot of small firms. There's also, and I think the District of Columbia is actually unique, the District of Columbia Superior Court has panel attorneys for special education. So if there's a family that comes into court through the abuse and neglect or delinquency system, just like they can get an attorney appointed to a parent who's been charged with neglect, if a judge sees fit or if another party sees fit, they can appoint a special education attorney and you can get on that panel if you have some experience and if you're interested in going into practice on your own, that's one way to do it after you've gotten a couple years. In terms of, so that's something to think of just in the future, is that there are even opportunities to be a solo practitioner in the district. The Children's Law Center, our office, Advocates for Justice and Education, and there are several other small nonprofits that do parent advocacy and parent practice that hire externs. I think in terms of if you want to do direct legal services, if you want to do any kind of direct legal services, it's good to get some experience actually working with clients because some people do hate it, and it's not a good thing. Not because they're bad people, but some people really do hate it, and it's not a bad thing. It's a bad thing to find that out when you're in a job. And that's the basic. Also, the externship there is a fabulous place to meet. I was there this year, and there were actually a lot of nonprofits and some educationally oriented that were talking about jobs. And I don't know if you
and we were at the externship fair.
Oh, that's great.
I think, I'm pretty sure Ed was there as well. Maybe, I know OCR well, usually comes
in. Yeah, yeah, I know.
That's the extent of the advice I have. It's just gets some experience doing it. I did the $10 youth court while I was in law school, which helped me figure out that I like working with teenagers and I think they're okay people. I tried to do things that, so just had to figure that out.
So I think there's a lot of opportunities. And I think, you know, as you come out of law school, you really have this luxury of getting to learn a lot of different things. So if you find yourself at a law firm, it's very possible somebody's got a case that's involving a school or a parent or a college or university, and find your way to that case. Because the next time that another school issue pops up, they're going to go to the people that were working on that. And so even if it's not a school practice that you find yourself at and you're interested in that area, try to find those cases because you can almost develop a practice. It's funny to me because I think a lot of the folks that I worked with right out of law school who were partners or were, you know, very senior in the career or about to retire, they all fell into school law. It was just at the time in the 80s and 90s, all of a sudden schools were either being sued or, you know, had legal issues and they were finding attorneys. It was just a matter of, well, who has worked with the school before? Oh, that person on that case, okay, now we're going to go hire them. And sure enough, the school law practices emerged. At this point, firms are opening up. I know in Chicago and in Ohio, there's, you know, firms throughout the state that do this kind of work representing school districts or colleges. And I started actually at the state working in the Attorney General's office in the education section. And so that the state level is always an option. You can go look at the Department of Education in the state you're from or if you're going to Queen, D.C. Look there because they have attorneys. Then the Attorney General's office at the state level should have attorneys that work on school issues. You may have a Board of Regents that works on higher education issues at the state level. Government jobs often don't pay a lot, but it's a great way to get in the door and to get a broad range of experience. If you really are interested in a law firm and you know education law is your area, you can start looking at firms that actually specialize in this work. You've talked here about parent advocacy, which is really important. I mean, if that's your side, that we need good people on both sides, because the worst thing is you have this really important matter, this really important case that impacts a student, and you end up and you've got a bad attorney on the other side, or worse yet, you don't have an attorney, because these issues become very emotional. You need good lawyers on both sides to really hammer out what's the right thing for the kid. Now, I used to work on the school board side of it, so I worked with management, and I did this in Ohio and in Illinois. I can tell you, I was very proud of my practice, possibly most proud of my practice, because I built relationships with people who were really interested in doing a good job for kids. I don't think I had one experience with a principal or a superintendent who, you know, they were just trying to screw over a parent or screw over a kid. They really had good intentions. These were good people that were really trying to do the right thing. And oftentimes it's a miscommunication, it's a parent and teacher not getting along. It's something like that. And if you can step in and fix that, it's a great experience, a learning experience for both you and, I like to say, the teaching moment for possibly the teacher or the principal or the parent or the kid. And so I would say look at those firms that do that kind of work. And then also, if anybody's interested in interning during their school year, you know, here, D.C. is just a hub. There's so much to do. You've got all of the advocacy organizations, all the trade associations are all located in D.C. My office, U.S. Department of Education, is here, and we love interns. We absolutely love them. We will set up any kind of internship where a student wants to come in and earn credit. Money's always hard, but if you want that kind of experience, you get that on your resume, and you start building your career in education law. You can go pretty much everywhere.
Great. Well, I appreciate all those insights, and I think it's time for you all to ask some questions. So, Jesse, you want to take the first question?
First of all, Professor, it's an awesome change of pace, so thank you for setting this up.
You're welcome.
I think this is a question that's inspired by Ms. Maselli, but obviously applies to everyone. I think you've used kind of some battle language in terms of like winning and the other side and whatnot. And for those people that are interested in a career in educational law, to what extent and in what capacities can we expect to confront forces that are trying to defund districts, or in light of the recession and budget cuts, how does that affect all of these myriad opportunities in education law that has been referenced? To what extent is the climate different now for people who are looking for opportunities in education law than it was, say, 5 years ago?
You know, actually, and I'm just thinking back to when I was in Chicago working for a firm. So we were a little law boutique, about 50 attorneys. We had an education practice group, and we had a labor and employment practice group. And our labor and employment group did a lot of private sector work, some public sector, but mostly private. We were entirely a public sector practice group. And I would say that when the economy really started kind of tanking, our business was good. Schools still had legal issues, and their municipalities, they still pay their bills. They can pay their bills, and you can't charge them a ton. But I would say that the business was still there. You know, it's not when the economy isn't doing so well. You still have parents that are suing. You still have disputes. You still have contracts. You still have services that have to be provided. There's all kinds of legal work. So I don't know that schools have been really hit hard as far as they don't have enough money to pay their bills, but they've certainly been hit hard.
Right.
Resources are tight for schools. But it's not like you've got an entire industry that simply just can't cover itself. I don't know if I've answered your question. Yeah, I think there's still opportunities there. There's definitely need for good education attorneys.
Well, and just to dovetail on that, especially in light of, you know, in the District of Columbia in particular, or it's the only area I know, yeah, there certainly is a resource issue in the DC public school system, and as a parent's attorney, you have an opportunity to navigate that, which is sometimes tough, because you'll be faced with a school that cannot afford the program that the kid needs, and so that's where I see kind of funding issues come up in my practice, is that, you know, some legal decisions are made by the other side based on cost, and sometimes you can deal with that through settlement negotiation. Sometimes you have to go to trial on an issue that is resource-based, more or less.
And I guess the only other thing I add, and maybe I see this, I guess I think about it most in the context of higher education general counsel's offices, so like university and college general counsel offices. I think to some extent it depends where you are. I mean, I was just reading an article this morning basically saying that the University of Nevada, Las Vegas thinks that the entire university, I think maybe the entire system might go bankrupt. I think it's actually very seriously considering this because of the state of the budget in Nevada. I think for better or worse, I think it's actually likely that that's going to fall harder on the teaching mission and on the faculty than I would suspect on the general counsel's office or other administrative positions. But I think there are a lot, but that may not be true, and I think that a lot of systems, especially state systems that are being hit extremely hard, are trying to kind of spread the pain out over both kind of the mission focus of the university and the administration, sort of the things that are keeping it running. But I, sort of the flip side is that I think, especially at college and universities, I think general counsel's offices tend not to be overstaffed. They are, frankly, very hard jobs to get. They're fantastic jobs, and people love them. And so they stay for years and for decades. There's a community that there's sort of a network of college and university attorneys that are truly, I think, the happiest group of attorneys I've ever known. It's really an amazing group. But I think that means also that that their offices, that once you're in them, once they're set, largely aren't shedding people either because they're basically needed to do the work of the institution.
Just to pick up on something Rachel just said, I actually had the opportunity to clerk at the National Association of College and University Attorneys in law school, NACUA, yeah. And they're always hiring law clerks. Absolutely fabulous experience. And I know that AU, actually, our general counsel, also has been here for decades, Mary Karen.
It's terrific general counsel's office.
Yes. Yeah. And she loves to hire WCL alums in particular. So I would strongly recommend their most recent hire a few years ago is a WCL alum. And he externed there while he was in law school. And so I they don't have a lot of positions. I think they may have five or six attorneys.
Right.
Staff, but.
Yeah, and you know, NACUA is a really good idea, and that's actually made me think that one other thing, for people who are interested in going into general counsel offices at a college or university, there are several, I would have to think of which one, there are several that have fellowship programs mm-hmm. specifically for students who are coming right out of law school. A couple of them focus really hire only from the law school at the university. So if AU has a program, it might be just for students here. I know GW has a fellowship program, but I think they hire only GW law grads. I may be wrong about that. I'm also pretty sure Hopkins has a program, I think, and they don't have a law school, so they must be hiring from elsewhere. And I think NYU has a fellowship program, I think, which I think is more with it. I think people can apply for more widely. So certainly if there are people here who are interested specifically in that area, which I think would be a fantastic area to practice in, really as a career, I think going into a college and university counsel office would be wonderful. There are some fellowship programs to think about, which is really a way to get experience right out of law school. Yeah.
There's also some related fields, I think, in higher ed that may not be the traditional in-house attorney's position, but also are very rewarding and can be a step towards a general counsel's office. And I'm specifically thinking about the administrative positions and handling things like conflict resolution or handling student discipline matters at a university. Those positions often hire attorneys to handle and manage those cases, those caseloads.
And doing sort of assistant dean type positions to student affairs.
Yeah. So just back to your question, you know, legal work is mission critical for any organization, which is why I think that, you know, yeah, schools are struggling. Absolutely. Resources are just not there as they used to be. But the legal work is still critical to the operation of any organization, school district level, college level, whatever. So there are going to be jobs out there, but if you get one of them, part of your job will be trying to find a way to do more with less. That means your time, trying to avoid costly litigation, work towards agreements, settlements, because you just don't have the money to do what you might have done 5 years ago.
Yes, Janelle. I had a question. I think this is more specifically for Sarah. So being a fellow in a DC public school, you know, I do feel like I'm seeing things for a public school system that I've never been exposed to. I think DC public schools are different for two reasons. Number one, because it's the only federal funded school system, and with that comes sort of a confusion for me about specifically like IEPs and different things for the students. Like we've had students where they're supposedly supposed to have an IEP or some sort of assistant to help them, you know, get through all of their studies, but instead they're just held back. Some of them are put in special education classes, but it's more so for disciplinary things than actual learning disabilities. And I'm just wondering, in your practice, you know, how do you even sort of attack those issues, or, you know, in through what you do, you know, how do you sort of address that? Because I think DCPS, for me, I'm sort of seeing things that are more socioeconomic conditions rather than necessarily all the kids have learning disabilities, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, generally, in terms of how our office approaches cases, is that one of the first things we do is make sure that a kid has a good working evaluation, which we often have to go outside of DCPS for, and I do not know what that reason is. And DCPS is sort of an odd animal in terms of the way education happens and the way it's funded, especially now with the departure of the chancellor and the new chancellor coming in and all the stuff the chancellor redid. If you want to stay in the District of Columbia, educational advocacy here has a political twist now because of everything that's happened with Chancellor Reed and the overhaul of the schools and whether or not that's really working. This is all being followed daily in the Washington Post, if you guys are have been following it. You raised several issues in your question. Getting records from the school are an issue for me, and I write a lot of scary letters and make a lot of phone calls, so I can imagine that they're an issue for teachers. Getting IEPs in particular is difficult. I have a child right now who's in a new school, and he can't read, and we can't get his IEP out of his old school. I don't know why. You know, literally, we've been calling every day for 2 weeks, and we still don't have it. Our approach is generally to get the kid evaluated, figure out what's going on, talk to everybody in the kid's life who will talk to us, figure out what the kid needs, and go from there. And often that's litigation preceded by several attempts to get the school on board, see if the school is willing to do something to address the need. Is that...
Yeah, sort of. I mean, and that definitely answers a part of my question. And I guess I'm just wondering, how far do you go onto the side? Well, it's not this. It's not that this child needs an IEP. It's the fact that it's just, you know, you're putting them in a class for special education when it's really disciplinary problems. Or I guess I'm trying to figure out how would, you know, someone in your position address issues instead of it being, okay, this child doesn't have the correct IEP. What if they don't even need one? What if it's disciplinary problems or, you know, just money, lack of money to, you know.
I have yet to see a child who doesn't have a disability. I get children through BDC Superior Court System, which means, generally, a lot of other things have gone very, very wrong. Many of them traced usually to an unidentified or unaddressed mental illness. So those are the cases I'm seeing, is the child has been explosive in school for the last 3 years, or the child has been walking the halls instead of going to class. Psychological assessments, speech and language assessments, social histories can ferret out whether or not that's a disability or another issue. In terms of how the district handles attendance and discipline for non-disabled students, it's a nightmare with disabled students. And I you'd probably be a better judge than I am, being there every day, as to why that is, and how to address that. You know, Caitlin...
Banner. She talked to us a few weeks ago.
Okay, so yeah. Caitlin Banner works for the Discipline Project at UDC. I don't know what to tell you other than that. It's frustrating. Generally, I do not see unidentified... Like, I do not see children who do not have special needs being put in special education classes. I see children with special needs being put in the wrong special education classes. I see a lot of children who shouldn't be in an inclusion classroom getting lost. I had a child 2 years ago, and then I promise I'll eventually start telling stories about children, who was mentally retarded, learning at the level of an 8-year-old. There was a miscalculation on his IQ scores. He wound up in a 9th grade class with a little help. It was a disaster, and it took a year and a half to get him out of there. I'm sure that it's happening, because I know that hall sweeps are a big thing right now, and those don't help anybody. But what's being done to address the needs of children without disabilities who are still being unfairly treated, that's not my area of expertise. But we know what's going on, because when I, and Caitlin Banner, I'm sure, talked to you about this. You know, when I say, I've had about, I feel like 100 meetings with the school where they say, oh, she got suspended because of a hall sweep, and I say, you aren't allowed to do that. You aren't allowed to suspend a child out of school for being in the halls. There's tears. You need to follow them. There's crickets. So...
Any other questions? I actually noticed something that you all mentioned that you have in common, and I wonder whether this is something that just sort of happened or you purposely chose this, but I noticed that you all talked about the value of working with people who have experience, who you respect, in terms of, you know, not just experience, but good attorneys who do work that you feel is meaningful, and also people not only who are good attorneys but who seem to really like what they do. Is that something that you, I think that's a really important point, and I hope that students sort of think about that, even though there is pressure right now, I know, to find good jobs, but also to think about, you know, finding people who are going to mentor you, who are going to actually care about your own development. So I wondered if any of you wanted to comment on that. Sure, I'll start. I absolutely think it's important to work with people that, you know, that you like and respect, whether they're, I mean, kind of depending on the position you're in, whether they're fellow attorneys or just colleagues in some way, or potentially, I think not even, it could even be somebody who's not a colleague, you know, at your particular office, but finding somebody in a community that you're in to be a good mentor. You know, it's one of the things that I think about a lot that I think I'm actually not as good at doing as I would like to be, which is I think there are some people who are very good at really doing kind of affirmative outreach and basically finding somebody and saying, will you be my mentor? Mm-hmm. And I think people are incredibly receptive to that. You know, I think if you're either in a field that you really enjoy and you're kind of trying to figure out, okay, I'm at sort of this level, how do I get to the next level, or just generally how do I progress and succeed in this career, or you're in an area and you're thinking, well, there are things about this that I don't love, but there are aspects that I like, and I see, you know, aspects in another field that I would enjoy. I think people are incredibly responsive to having people approach them and saying, you know, I'm interested in what you do. I admire what you do. I admire the way you do it. And, you know, I'd like, whether it's saying, will you be my mentor, or, you know, will you talk to me, generally. You know, and generally over the last year or so, I've just been having sort of a lot of conversations with people, not so much in a mentorship, not so much in terms of looking for their mentorship, but just finding out more about what are people doing and how did they get there? What is it they enjoy about their positions? And those have been incredibly interesting and incredibly rewarding conversations. And I do think that people are almost always willing to have them. And I think finding people that you work with kind of in any circumstance, either to say, you know, that person has the kind of career that I want, how do I get that? Or just even being able to kind of piece out parts of people's practice or the way you see them deal with people or the way you see them deal with issues and be able to start to take some models from that, definitely I think is really valuable.
Very much with what Rachel said. Also, when you graduate and are practicing, you'll find other lawyers in your field who have more experience than you. I've made a habit of calling some of them to have developed mentorship relations that way because, you know, one of the great things about the practice of law is it can be collaborative, which means if you're stuck on a case, you can call someone else. My office is very small, so I found that it helps to call someone and bounce ideas off them, and people are very receptive to that, especially, I mean, I don't know about any other field, but especially in direct legal service where client issues can be kind of thorny and unique, and their ethical issues and their representation issues and their who gets to make these decisions issues, and it's really helpful to bounce them off other lawyers. In terms of ways you can meet other lawyers, when you become a member of the bar, there are a lot of young bar member events. Additionally, the DC Bar sponsors a huge amount of trainings, some of them free, some of them not, which is a good place to meet other lawyers in other fields. And I've had some success with that, getting help on cases and also just kind of networking with attorneys in different practices.
I think having a mentor or even just a colleague that you are developing some mutual respect for is immensely helpful to anybody's practice, especially as a younger lawyer. And it's not just that you need somebody like a teacher who's going to say, you need to do this, then you do this, and walk you through the process. But to Sarah's point here, she said, you know, the law is collaborative, and it's becoming so much more collaborative. I think the old model was the fewest amount of attorneys on any project because that was all the client was really willing to pay for. And so a lot of people worked in these silos and did very similar work but very independent of each other. And what I think a lot of lawyers are finding out now is that as they work more collaboratively on problem solving, and oftentimes lawyers are not just being brought in to handle this case or to handle this you know, the specific isolated issue, but rather to work with the team of, you know, your clients to problem solve and brainstorm. You need more people working together and knowing how to do that. And if you have a mentor who you go to and he or she comes to you and you can hash out issues, you kind of learn how to be a collaborative lawyer. And that is incredibly important. And I also think it's not natural for our folks in our profession. For some reason, I've come across, you know, just the folks that seem to go into law, one, we're all a little neurotic, and two, there's a little bit of ego to the way we approach our work. And you've got to learn how to put all of that aside, because I promise you, even if you're working with somebody who's not maybe as good of a writer as you are, your writing product is going to be better if they look at it, if they offer some input. But it's hard to get through that, and I think a mentor is the one person, somebody you trust, develop a relationship with one person who can really teach you that skill.
I think that's great. And one thing that you sort of hit on is that I think sometimes it's intimidating for students to think, well, why would this person who's got 35 years of experience, you know, practicing this area, well, why would they want to spend time talking to me? But I think mentoring is incredibly rewarding for the mentor as well. And you guys know that. You're teaching now. Imagine one of your students came to you and said, would you be my mentor? And that would be really important, wouldn't it? And you'd love to share with them any, you know, bumps in the road or advice. I think it's the exact same thing with attorneys. So,
if I could add to that point, I just went through, I think, in the last year, a really interesting learning experience, and I cannot wait for all of you to kind of come to this point in your career. But I have an attorney, 35 years. We call him Gandalf in the office because he knows everything. And in the last year, he's been coming to me, and this was somebody when I was an intern I worked for, and now he comes to me for my input and my advice. And I keep thinking, you know, I'm not 10 years out of law school. And yet, he's looking for my advice. I can tell you that even your mentors and folks that are much more seasoned and experienced attorneys than you, you have something to add to. And it's so hard. And I think coming out of law school and your first 5-6 years of practice, you are never going to believe it. But in reality, you have so much to give to that more senior person. You come from a different perspective, a different generation. You know, a lot of our legal issues now deal with technology or are involved in technology issues. You can be a resource to that person too, and you just gotta realize that there's gonna come a point where people even more senior than you are gonna seek out your advice, and you should be ready to give it. Even you know your first year out on the job, if you have an opinion, give it.
No, go ahead. And what I would add to that is, I think that's a really good point. And what I would add to that also is, you know, by and large, and obviously you have to gauge the people that you're working with and working for, but if you have a question, ask it. I think that can be an incredibly hard thing to do, often at any stage. I mean, I think some of this is a function of in-house practice. There is certainly, maybe I've had a day go by. I certainly have not had a week go by where I've thought, oh, I basically have a handle on all of the legal issues that are coming up this week. I think as a lawyer, and frankly, especially as a young lawyer, and maybe especially as a young female lawyer, I don't know, it can be hard to ask those questions because you sort of, I know at least this is something I fall into, is sort of wanting to seem fully competent in every area. And you just can't be. I mean, I think almost no matter what stage of your practice you're at, I think certainly for people who get much more senior and are specializing in an area, they probably really do get to a point where they know that area inside and out. But I think for most of us, you know, there are new things coming up. I think especially when one of my colleagues told me something that actually I wished he had told me about a year earlier, but I think was very good advice, which was that when you start someplace, I think you especially have a lot of latitude to ask questions before anybody even thinks that you should really sort of have a lot of expertise about what you're doing. But even after that, I think asking both because there's always something that somebody can add and because I think that that's actually part of the way that you add value. Truly, I think being willing to ask questions, I mean, really a lot of what asking questions is raising issues. And maybe somebody will say, that's not an issue and that's an incredibly stupid question, I can't believe you asked it. But the chances are it's not. And that I think is part of how you can add value regardless of the level you're at, is being willing to ask questions and raise issues that other people may not be, either because they're afraid to ask the question or because they've asked something else that you wouldn't have thought of. So,
great tips. Yet you, if nobody else has questions. Jensie always has great questions, but I just want to make sure anyone else, if anyone has any questions or thoughts to share. Rob?
This goes to everybody on the panel, but I just had a general comment. I know in a lot of your jobs you say that you find happiness in it, and I know as like a lot of us, we have jobs, we think to ourselves, like, would we be happy in this particular field? But there are some days in being a Marshall Brennan Fellow where it gets frustrating. And it's not so much with the students, but it's like the administration. And so I just want you guys' comments on how is it that you reconcile conflicting views in your jobs with your own personal beliefs, and how you kind of hold your own in your job, if that makes sense.
Wow. There's no answer to that question. I can try. So one of the really important parts of being a good lawyer is remembering to be objective. And it's hard in this field. There's a lot of emotional issues. You get attached. You get interested. But you have to remember your role in order to really do your job well. And sometimes you're going to forget your role, and you're just going to get completely in the middle of a really emotional situation and you're going to feel really strongly about something, you've got to find a way to separate yourself from it. You have to. But that doesn't mean you're not fighting the good fight and you're not staying true to your personal beliefs. But your job is to be objective. And I think I said earlier in answering a question that why it's so important to have two good lawyers working on either side of a issue involving, you know, a special ed kiddo or a student with disabilities or a student who's being hurt at school. Because you've got teachers and parents who are emotionally connected to it. Your job is to keep them that kind of in check. It's hard, but you have to. So the balance.
I think, and this is going to sound so Dr. Phil, right? Self-care is so important because you need to be in a place where you're not going to scream at someone because they're being a moron. And they often are. And I find that really hard. As you know, I said I would try to stop telling stories about kids. I have a child who's in Geometry 2. He's never taken Geometry 1, and he's in Geometry 2 because it's the only special education math class at this school. So I've spent the last 2 weeks trying to fix this, and I have not succeeded. And it's, the kid's not very happy in the math class, surprisingly. And I know what, and like, I've spent a lot of time and energy, like, taking a breath, reading a stupid article on the Washington Post, so when I get on the phone with that person, the first words out of my mouth are, what's wrong with you, right? Because you do not want to be that crazy lawyer that's always depicted in the New Yorker cartoons, like jumping up and down on the table. That's not who you want to be. It's bad for you, it's bad for your client, it's bad for your relationship with the administration. And what you want to do, especially in this practice, is be the person that even the school is going to think of as, if not their favorite person in the world, reasonable. Because if you're not taking care of yourself, or I find that if I'm not taking care of myself, I'm so much more likely to yell or snap or just say something that's going to be taken the wrong way, and that's going to impair my relationship with that person. Even if they are begging for it to be impaired, by the way. Like, I'm not saying that that's easy at all. I mean, this kid's in the wrong math class. He's been in the wrong math class for like 2 months, but no amount of yelling is going to change that. But approaching that situation in a reasonable way. I watch a lot of television. I watch a lot of television and bad television. I do not listen to NPR. I found that that's a good way to kind of disengage from the situation. I watch Pretty Little Liars. I'm proud of that. It's a good show. And while I'm watching it, I do not think of special education issues are my job. And it's important to have those things, even if they're totally embarrassing. And to be taking care of yourself so that you can be a good advocate for your clients and so that you're not a crazy person, which is important in your field.
Before I answer, can you just say a little bit, I mean, I think their answers have been great. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean or what you're asking?
No, I mean, there's sometimes, and I think you hit it too, I mean, we have special needs students and they're in the classroom of 30 and you just wonder, why is the student here? Why don't we have additional help? And then one time, I think me and Fernando, he's my teaching partner, we go into the lounge, and there's a guy just randomly there, and then we say, hey, what's your name? And he's like, well, I teach special needs students. And I was like, you mind? We have some students in our classroom. And, I mean, there's times we want to go to the principal and say, hey, you know, what's up? I mean, is there a way you could help us lower our class size and stuff like that? My question is how, you know, can you be reasonable at the same time? Don't burn any bridges with the administration and stuff like that, because it's just sometimes it's hard. Sometimes you feel like going in and saying, come on now. I mean, is there anything you could do that to improve conditions?
In that particular situation?
I don't know what your teacher says that you should do. I can't about
we've had a lot of conversations about their situation.
I
think it's a universal challenge that the fellows face, is that they're suddenly, you know, most of them did not go to schools like DC public high schools. And so they're now in situations where they see administrators overwhelmed, teachers overwhelmed. Just sort of nothing's functioning the way that I think any parent would want it to, or any child certainly would. And so it becomes frustrating for them because they feel like they may be in a position to do something about it. But actually, in some ways, they're not. They're only there for 9 months. And, you know, from the system's perspective, they're sort of temporary workers.
I think you can absolutely try. I think you can also know, not to be in the key of Dr. Phil again, that it means something to the kids in that room that you're there. and that you're trying, and they can see that. And if you're trying to make things better for them, and they know you're talking to the administration, they can see that too. And you need to do what you can do in the parameters of your program, certainly. But you know, I think some of those conversations will yield fabulous results, and some won't yield anything at all. And if it's any comfort to you, you'll have that same experience as an attorney, where sometimes they'll bring an issue up, and it'll be responded to like that, and it'll be a dream, and you'll want to fill the emails up on your wall or make a little collage of them, and then sometimes it won't go that well. And then you'll be in court.
Okay, Jess. Oh, Colin. And then we'll come back to you, Jess. I swear.
I had a question about what it's like to work at an agency in the federal government where you have career employees and have workforce employees. And what are the
certainly are, and so are political appointees. And I think that the stereotype is, yes, that there's some sort of divide between your political staff and your career staff. And I think the Department of Education may be unique in this, and it's just my experience. Our career staff are incredible. We have, though, a highly educated workforce. Most of the folks that work in the policy shops as career staff or career attorneys, well, attorneys all have law degrees, but our policy folks, they all have graduate degrees. I mean, we are just a very well-educated agency. And I would say that the career staff at the Department of Education is the most valued asset that the political appointees have. We need them. We look at them as a team. And it's true that in past administrations, that may not have been the same relationship. But this administration knows that we have very lofty goals, big ideas, and we want to get a lot done. And education is, I think, the most important domestic issue that we have facing this generation. And so we're working four times as hard as perhaps any other education administration has. We can't do it all. There's only so many politicals. So I'm one of the general counsel, one deputy general counsel, two, maybe five politicals in an office of about 100 attorneys. And not having their support and their buy-in and their hard work and their input, we would be lost. So I know that there's this strange dynamic, but at least at the Department of Education, I feel like we're doing a really good job getting over it. It is fun for career staff, at least in my office, career attorneys, to poke fun at the political. I was pretty much one-third of the entire winter holiday skit. You know, we had about an hour and a half of skits, and a third of it was poking fun at Miss Sully, you know, the chief of staff. And that's good fodder, but it's also good team building, and I feel like there's a respect there. You need your career staff. They have been, you know, they're your eyes and ears on the ground. They know these programs. They know the law. They know the history. If you don't count on your career staff, you're shooting yourself in the foot.
I have excuse me if I didn't answer to this, that was great. And thank you for coming out. It sounds like you all had a really busy, hard job that requires you perhaps to be there right now. So.
We paid them a lot of money.
But my question to you all is, I guess it could be personal. You know, each one of you all has a specific job that tackles education law, big umbrella sort of idea about fixing education, whatever capacity that you do. But I was just wondering what you all think is necessary personally to fix the issue of education so that there aren't kids. Because you said, I forget who said that they had their, and I'm sorry, it's Rachel?
Oh, me, Rachel, yeah.
White party, you said that you had. Yeah, family, your dad, that's my mom's a teacher, so she comes home and she's just like, this kid needs the IEP and he can't get one, you know, the school just won't give it to him, they don't think he's in front of him, but obviously he stuck thumb on the wall and tried to get himself to the gun afterwards. There's something going on with this kid, you know, there's a lot of different things that are going on in the classroom. What do you think needs to happen so that those changes and what needs to happen, whatever it is, happens? How do you
I should defer to these guys on that very important question.
Can you take a stab?
Sure.
That's why I'm at the agency. Fixing public education, wow. Let's talk about improving public education, because that's really, I think, something that's what we're able to do. Fixing it, I don't have an answer for you. But there's so many things that go into a quality education. Do you have really well-trained staff and teachers that can recognize, a disability when they see it? Do you have parents who are supporting the child at home? Do you have resources to provide that child with exactly what they need on an individualized basis so that kid can succeed? Do you have opportunities for that kid to, stimulate other curiosities, the arts and music and things that will just make for a well-rounded education? That's resources, that's talent, with the teachers. Do you have a strong teaching core, a strong leadership core? Do you have strong administrators and principals leading a school? Do those folks all have good professional development? There's so many different things that we need. And you also need the parents. You need the parents at the table. You need their buy-in. They need to be working with their kids when they come home and knowing where they are after school. So we are trying to find ways to improve all of that. So we have a whole set of series, almost a battery of programs that will improve the leadership at schools, the teaching force. Try to get the folks that are the highest educated out of colleges and say, hey guys, I know you think you can go make a ton of money in the private sector, but this should be your calling. We have programs that will try to take kids like you guys, and instead of going into your $100,000 a year job at a law firm, take you and put you into the classroom where you can do something, where you can really mean something to a group of kids. So then we also have programs that are trying to make sure that teachers have the right data so they can track kids. How are they doing as they progress? Are they hitting this particular teacher and then all not doing so well year after year after year? Or are they hitting this particular math program and then all of a sudden you're getting a higher than average group of kids going into mathematics? Hey, that's great. We need data systems to do that. We need the right kind of resources. We're trying to find ways to improve the local, state, and federal investment in education. And we need education to be more innovative. We need kids to learn technologies, kids to start learning different kinds of vocations. The vocations of the last generation are not the vocations of this one. So there's so much to be done. And I think the real key at how you improve education in this country is you get everybody to the table. You need your teachers, your parents, your school administrators, your unions, state legislatures, the folks with the money, the governors. You have to get them at a table and talking about these issues because everybody contributes. If you have a splintered group, you're not going to be able to get these things done.
I don't have too much time for that.
But I think, just in terms of when I see the district and the problems with education, I have to say that I don't see unfixable children. I actually see kids who are like 17, 18, 19 years old get into the right school program or get the right resources, and they do great. And I've seen, so I don't think that there's an expiration date on any child. And I think sometimes there's that idea. In terms of specific things that I see that need to be done and that could be done, reading is really important. And I work with a lot of children who have serious reading delays, and they can't read menus, they can't read math problems, they can't read job applications, they can't read in class, and it's humiliating, and it keeps them out of school. Because if you can't read, you do not want to be. The children I work with, if they cannot read, they do not want to be in the classroom, whether they get picked on for it, which many of them do, or not. And the other thing is vocational and transitional planning and opportunities. A lot of the children I work with have not seen their transcript until they're in my office, which means they do not know how many credits they've earned, they do not know how many community service hours they need, and they do not know when they are going to graduate and if that will happen, although they think it will. They are not told what options they'll have in terms of college. They're not told how to get into college. A lot of the kids I work with have never heard of the SAT or the ACT, although college is checked on their educational documents. They don't know about trade schools, they don't know about vocational training, and there are a lot of great programs in the district, and I'm listing all of these things because those are things that you can do through your own community service. And I know that DCPS is working to create more opportunities for children in those areas, and I'm sure you are as well, but there's also, you all can actually really address that because mentors can help with that, and reading tutors can help with that, and that's something that we can all pitch in a little bit on in terms of just filling the gap, because there's a big service gap in both of those areas that I see, but it's not one that absolutely has to be addressed in the classroom. If it's not being addressed in the classroom, there are other resources through which that can be delivered to children. So that's one way I see it, is that I think if everybody gets a little bit more involved in what's going on with teenagers in particular, and just being an advocate for one teenager in your community, sitting down with them, talking to them about college essays and where they want to go and if they want to go, they're not, the teenagers that I work with, and I actually teach Sunday school too, like they're often not getting that information soon enough, and so they get to 16 or 17 and they think they're on one track and they have none of the stuff they need to have in place. And that's something I certainly got as a kid. I'm sure it's something that most of you got too, is what you need to do to get into college or what you need to do if you want to take a year off, and they're not getting it. So.
And I think all of the panelists know this, but to the extent that you don't, these guys are absolutely every day bridging those gaps. I mean, just today alone, a couple of you came to talk to me or asked about writing a recommendation letter for one of your students. We're doing a big bake sale today to raise money for awards for the MCOR competition that we're hosting in April. Some of you have brought in guest speakers. Mary Beth Tinker went to speak to one of our classes today.
Oh, cool.
So they're really, doing tremendous work on a daily basis to kind of expose the students to different opportunities.
Well, I just to say one more thing. You're seeing them as teenagers, and being a teenager is hard. You're having a big impact on where they're going to be when they're 30, and no one knows where they're going to be, but it's possible that they'll be looking back on your class and saying that that was a moment that really changed things for them.
Let's take one last question, and Jesse, do you want to be the one last question?
Owen. How many of your colleagues are actual, I guess, had teaching experience or classroom experience so that they're coming to their legal jobs with on-the-ground training?
So I'm not going to lie. At the law firm I came from in Chicago, I would say that almost a third of our practice group had teaching experience, and I would say that was the third that was by far serving their clients the best out of all of us. There really is something to be said for having spent time in a classroom, knowing the struggles that principals and teachers and parents deal with on a day-to-day basis. That doesn't mean you can't be a very competent and good education attorney. But if you've got teaching background, or you continue kind of doing this work, or volunteer and stay connected to a classroom, I just think it'll help your practice.
I have 1.5 colleagues. we all have some experience working with children. I find that it's not, I worked in youth court and I've taught on and off in various settings, but not a full classroom. I find that even if you don't, even if you do have teaching experience, it's really helpful as a parent's advocate to be able to say to the teacher, I do not do what you do, and I know that you're facing challenges that I can't understand, so that they understand that you respect them.
I guess, thinking about it from a higher ed point of view, in terms of legal colleagues, same, I have one. Neither of us came from a teaching background. Most of our colleagues in the office do have an academic background. And I think probably in sort of higher ed practice, I don't know what percentage of them come from a teaching background. I think a lot of them either serve as adjunct faculty in some way or kind of have at various periods during their careers and or have gotten involved in, this is sort of different, but have gotten involved in an organization like NACU or something like that and are sort of doing presentations, doing a lot of professional work. It's actually one of the things that I think in terms of my practice, it would probably be even more helpful to either have had a teaching background or to be doing some adjunct work just to be kind of seeing, or even to have had some kind of administrative position, having been a dean, something like that, and sort of seen things from, quote-unquote, the other side, I think is always helpful. That's a very good question. And we have a lot of alums all over the country doing doing this kind of work, whether it's directly as attorneys or as administrators at universities or working for state and local government. So you guys definitely should know that I can put you in touch with them. Hopefully we can help you with that. Well, I want to thank the panelists so much for their time, and I echo what Angela said. There are lots of other things you could have been doing today, including being at work, and we certainly appreciate your time, and I know that the students do as well.
Absolutely. Department of Education, Office of the General Counsel, being me, I'm taking intern applications right now for the summer. We don't know that we're going to have funds to pay for interns, but we are still looking for folks who are interested in coming and working with us. So if you're interested, send me your resume. Yep, Marion's got my email address. If you think you can earn credit, if you can set that up with your law school, we're happy to work with them. Any law school, for anybody who's listening, really need some help this summer, and there's amazing issues to work on. I promise it will be an amazing experience.
And I would say for the AUP too, we are basically just at the end of our summer process, but we love having part-time semester interns as well. And I know my colleague Kathy often comes and talks to the program here, but if there are folks that are interested, we love having people.
We're always interested in people both in the summer, but we are looking for the fall or next spring.
Great. Thank you. Well, before I end this today, I just want to make a quick announcement. First of all, the bake sale has been very successful today. We had some competition, but many people came over to our table and said, your stuff looks better, so that was it.
Is the bake sale still going on?
It
That's
is.
An important question.
It is. All right.
You have to tell us where.
It's in the lobby. I wanted to just share with you, Emily just came in to tell me that we have a lot of chocolate chip cookies and brownies left over for tomorrow. So if you're still baking, if you're going to bring something tomorrow, if you could try to bring something different, that would be great. All right. Thanks, guys.